the law of God is broken into three parts, and the moral law, the civil law, the ceremonial law. And the question was asked, how do we even think about the civil and ceremonial law of the Old Testament today? Because, you know, you read our confession and it talks about how they've been abrogated. And so you could come away thinking, well, that means all civil law, all ceremonial law are totally gone, totally abrogated. All that's left is this ambiguous moral Ten Commandment thing. And what does that even mean? So what this section of the class is doing is preparing us to think about actual civil and ceremonial law in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Exodus later in the class. But we're doing it by looking at the larger catechism, Westminster Larger Catechism, and what they come up with in terms of what is required in the fourth commandment, what is forbidden in the fourth commandment, all these commandments, and looking to see if there is any kind of ceremonial or civil aspect to what is required or forbidden. So that as you're looking at specifics, your mind just doesn't go to, well, that's against the moral law of God. It goes to specifics. How is the moral law apply to civil life and ceremonial life? And we've gone through the first three for sure. And we've seen that in those three commands, in the way that they make application, that there is civil and ceremonial overlap in all three of those. And so looking at the fourth commandment, we've seen that there is some of that as well. Now, let's remember one more thing here for the Ten Commandments. The way we divide them, the first four mostly speak towards ceremonial, because this is dealing with our relationship with God vertically. The last six are more civil because they're dealing with our relationship with our fellow man. So I would think we should expect to find some kind of ceremonial overlap in the first four and some kind of civil overlap in the last six. But do we find the others in each one as well? And so that's the specific focus. But again, if you have comments or questions about the commandments as we're going through these, then feel free to ask those as well. So let's go through the fourth again. And fourth commandment is just the Sabbath day. We read that last time. So let's look at question 116. What is required in the fourth commandment? Fourth commandment requires of all men the sanctifying or keeping holy to God such set times as he has appointed in his word, expressly one whole day in seven, which was the seventh from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ, and the first day of the week ever since, and so to continue to the end of the world, which is the Christian Sabbath in the New Testament called the Lord's Day. And then we can stop there. Looking at the requirements of the fourth commandment, essentially it's talking about there's a change. This is the way they talk about it. There's a change from the seventh day to the first day. And the change is because of Jesus' resurrection. Now, I have my own unique way of thinking about that, but I think it still deals with it still agrees with the heart of what they're saying. But yeah, go ahead, Dory.
Yeah, so I've been trying to puzzle this out myself. I've read what Seventh Day Adventists say. I've also read treatises or articles and things like that where they're like arguing: is the Lord's Day really the first day, or is it the seventh day? And the verses that typically are used to show that it's the first day, I've read explanations of how those have been interpreted wrongly. So I'm a little confused about it, frankly. I know the tradition is that it's the first day. And this is the issue that the Catholic Church booted Martin Luther off for. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, I didn't know that.
So he was complaining about their traditions of men, the different things they did that were traditions. And they said, you worship on Sunday and not Saturday. So that is a tradition of men. Therefore, you are now guilty of everything we're guilty of, so you can't say we're guilty and you're not. So therefore, with all these other things you're doing, we're, you know, out you go. So, and it wasn't that simple. But I've read a little bit about that, that was the actual issue over which Martin Luther had to say, oh, well, you know, I guess you're kind of right. So anyway, it's very confusing to me because I want to do what the Lord has commanded.
Right.
So
I can't speak to Martin Luther. I've never heard that before. I can talk a little bit to the idea of church tradition, okay? And this, like, I can't speak to the issue, so I don't know how they would respond to it, but whatever. So a couple of things. First of all of our earliest sources that I'm aware of talk about the first day of the week. And the first day of the week, they called it the Lord's Day, as early as we can find. Okay? So you go back to the apostolic fathers. Now, these are the guys who are writing really contemporary with the New Testament up until through the first century. These are as early sources as we have. Church fathers, technically, the church fathers actually come after the apostolic fathers. So we're dealing with Ignatius of Antioch, Shepherd of Hermes, these kinds of books, Polycarp. They talk about the Lord's Day. And when they talk about the Lord's Day, they mean the day of resurrection. Now, we have that in, several New Testament books, the first day of the week, and the idea of the Lord's Day. John is in the Spirit on the Lord's Day in Revelation. And I forget whether Paul uses taking tithes on the Lord's Day or the first day of the week. I forget which one he uses. He uses one of those two. So I've never seen anybody in the early church like argue against what this is. It would only be somebody coming along later that would say that. Second of all, is that I would say that we can add to that apostolic tradition. Apostolic tradition is a different level of tradition than all tradition that comes after it. Does that make sense? Timothy is not apostolic tradition. Timothy is second generation. His job is to carry on the apostolic tradition. Now, some of those apostolic traditions may not have been written down the way that we would like them to be. So did the apostles themselves, do they show signs that they were worshiping on the Lord's Day? And I would say they do show signs that they were doing that. I'm not prepared to give that kind of a lecture, but that would be my argument that they would do that. Third thing that I would say is that I actually don't like the language that they use here of it was this and then it's this, because that makes it sound like you're resting your whole case on tradition, even if it is apostolic tradition. That's why I argue that what we're doing in worshiping on the first day of the week is we literally are worshiping on the Sabbath. Old Testament Sabbath on the first day of the week. Why? Because there was more than one Sabbath in the Old Testament. Okay? There was a regular weekly Sabbath that was on Saturday. It happened 52 weeks a year. However, there were many special Sabbaths in the law, and these are almost always on the first day of the week. You have first day, and then you go to Day of Atonement. You've got three of them. It's a two-week festival. I think it's a Feast of Trumpets. It's one of those two. Where it's the first day of the week is called the Sabbath. The eighth day of the week is called the Sabbath. The 15th is called the Sabbath. Well, what are those? They're all the first day. All of them. And they're called what? Sabbath. So technically speaking, to worship on a special day on the first day of the week is not, it's not against the Old Testament at all. Like, that's literally what they were doing. Now, that doesn't necessarily explain should you only worship on Sunday and not also Saturday or something like that. That would be a different question. But to say that the Lord's Day is not a Sabbath, I would just take issue with that on those grounds. Okay? It's a different question of whether you should also worship on Saturday and Sunday. Take up that question.
Canada written also called Sunday the seventh day of the week. It's considered the last day of the week in Canada and Britain.
In America, it feels like
that's interesting.
Sunday is the last day of the week.
Right.
Well, it does feel that way. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I would like to get a little clarification on what the Catholic Church considers church tradition, because I believe that it's what the Pope has said.
Well, so...
and he can change it.
Yeah, he can change it at some points in time. He can't change it always. If he speaks ex cathedra,
right,
he may change it. I don't know how they do ex cathedra. I just don't know. They would obviously argue that every tradition that they have comes from the apostles. But it's an absurd claim. It's completely ridiculous. There's absolutely no way they can prove that. I mean, because they have so many traditions that they didn't exist for the first 1,500 years, and all of a sudden they do, but we got it from the apostles. I mean, that's like cult kind of stuff. That's what Mormons do, you know. There hasn't been a true church for this long. So, I mean, they can say what they want to say, but there's no doubt that tradition for them ends up going far beyond apostolic tradition.
That's my point. If you go back and read Halley's Bible commentary, whatever that book is, it goes through a whole lot of stuff about the Catholic Church that will open your eyes. And I really don't much want to pay any attention at all to what the Catholic Church says.
Well, let's remember again that the Catholic Church has at least carried down the Trinity. So we don't want to throw everything they've ever done out.
No, I don't.
But, Carl?
So get back to the distinction between Lord's Day and Sabbath. Your explanation sounds more like you define Sabbath less as seventh of Shabbat.
Right.
Hebrew number, but more like a separated day.
Yep, so Sabbath means rest. Now, there's a word play with the number seven in Hebrew, but Sabbath does not mean seven. It means rest. So, yeah.
That keeps up my question. So, not suggesting there's an either or, because I'm not suggesting that. Because I do think Sunday should be at rest forever, to whatever extent. But in light of Hebrews, to what extent is the Sabbath fulfilled? Is the rest fulfilled?
I mean, that's a $1 million question, right? Christians have been arguing about this for a long time. So first of all, put it this way. This has to be considered a secondary issue. This is not a primary issue. You guys remember, many of you remember Mike, who was our Jew. Our token Jew member. he wouldn't mind saying it. He would say it himself. And he continued as a Christian to keep Sabbath on Saturday. I didn't have a problem with that. If you want to do that, more power to you. But we're going to continue worshiping on the Lord's Day in this church in terms of when we gather together. So there remains a rest for God. I mean, you've got people that take this and they spiritualize it completely. Well, in Christ, now there is no Sabbath at all because, like, we are the Sabbath. You know, I don't know what they would want to do with that, but...
We
enter into his rest. That's a rest that he finished, right? It is finished. We entered into a way that they didn't in the Old Testament because he had not died for sin yet. The only practical question is, does this mean that we should stop worshiping on a particular day of the week? Right? So we enter into that rest. It's full rest that we have it every day of the week. But that's a different question of whether the church gathers together to publicly proclaim the gospel ever, or what day they should do it, or what days they should do it. You know, let's kind of go to the opposite extreme. There is no evidence anywhere in the early church that they forsook the worship on the Lord's Day because it was more practical for seekers to go to church on Tuesday night. That's a modern invention of the church. Now, we do know that in the book of Acts, they were actually gathering every day of the week at the beginning, right? We go to Acts 2 and They're in the temple every day. So if the church wants to gather every day of the week, I don't have a problem with that. The Catholic Church has Mass every day of the week. I guess if you want to do that, you can do that. It's kind of like, I don't know if it's a minimum sort of a thing, but what are we doing when we gather one day of the week? What are we doing? When we gather on the Lord's Day, what are we doing? We're doing one specific thing. We are proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus Christ together. That's what we're doing. And that's why it's the first day of the week. And I think Hebrews probably has something to say about that. Because, look, the type of the Old Testament rest that was the seventh day has come to a fullness that did not exist in the Old Testament. He literally died for sin now. It is finished. And so what that set, and this is good Puritan theology, what that seventh day pointed forward to has now been fulfilled. And so in a way, worshiping on Saturday is going back to types and shadows in the same way that demanding that we go to a temple to worship in would be. Temple worship hasn't ceased to exist, has it? It's just changed. How do we know that? The New Testament makes that very clear that it has changed to the church. We're the temple. So I look at it kind of along those lines. And it's not, like I said, it's a secondary issue and people disagree on this subject. So there can be people that really disagree with me on this subject and I'll say, okay. Yep. Go ahead, Jen.
So in the original Hebrew, when it says, honor the Sabbath day, is there a the there?
That's a good question. I would have to go back and look at the Hebrew because I don't have it up.
Because maybe part of the problem is we're trying to say the Sabbath as opposed to honor.
Yeah, my guess is that the is there.
Okay.
That's my guess. I haven't looked at that for a long time. Paul talks about various Sabbaths in Romans, and I think he talks about it probably in some of the smaller letters as well. And he actually talks about this as disputable matter himself. He actually uses Sabbath worship as disputable matter. Now, it is disputable matter because people don't agree on what Sabbath he's talking about. Is he talking about Pentecost Sabbath on the first day of the week? Or is he talking about the regular keeping of the Sabbath once a week? People disagree on that. But it is interesting, at the very least, to know that he considers this topic, to one degree or another, disputable matter. But like I said, we do not have any evidence that the church forsook the regular weekly, at least weekly, gathering of the saints. And Hebrews talks about that too, right? Some have forsaken the assembling together. Well, when did they assemble? They had to do it sometime. And it had to be regular, or else you couldn't break that commandment. Right? And everything we know is that they were doing it on the first day of the week.
Well, they couldn't really do it on the seventh day, right? Because they were supposed to rest. And they didn't, Jews didn't gather to worship on the seventh day. They, I mean, most of them couldn't go to the temple because it was more than a 7 days walk from the temple.
Well, that's true. At some point, the temple's gone, right? It gets destroyed. You have 40 years of, like, the church itself haggling over these issues of what should we do? The temple's still here. And, you know, at some point in time, the temple was no longer there, and they had to do something else. It could be, I've wondered about this, that they might have had the same problems that Jews in Israel to this day have. The whole country shuts down on Saturday, and then you go to work on Sunday, because that's what you do as a country. We don't have to worry about that in America because we've been a Christianized nation that set apart Saturday and Sunday and no for no work until just very recently because we were influenced by both of these two traditions. So, but in Israel, that's not the case. And so imagine yourself back then, the whole country shuts down on Saturday. That would have happened back then. And you're a Christian and you want to worship Jesus. But he died on the first day of the week. It would have been really easy for them to worship on Saturday and just do it in secret. Nobody would never know the difference. Or you could also, you know, you're not going to be working on Saturday because nobody works on Saturday. But now what are you going to do? How are we going to worship Jesus? Well, we're going to worship early on the first day of the week. And it's going to have to cost us something. I don't want to say it too strongly because I have friends that, like, they worship on Saturday because that's just what they've chosen to do. They do the same thing in Nepal. My friends in Nepal, they worship on Saturday because everything they have to open up on Sunday. They have to go to work. And it's easy to sit here and throw stones at people and say, well, why don't you just get up at 3 a.m. and worship on Sunday like Christians in the first century did? Well, I'm not doing that. So easy to cast stones in glass houses. Yeah.
Kind of off the subject a little bit, but COP27 just happened, and the Pope and very many other of the leaders who attended that are pushing to have a Sunday Sabbath, a green Sabbath.
Oh my.
Where everything shuts down, so one day the earth gets to rest.
Sure.
But it means one of the things you won't be able to do is drop. So if you go to church,
that's fascinating.
You can't even go to church anymore.
You can just worship the green man in Gaia in your home. Yeah, that sounds like a direct attack on Christian worship.
By the Pope.
By the Pope. Yeah. By the Pope. Yep. So that, you got more thoughts or questions about that, this part of it?
Thank you. That was helpful.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
So struggle with gray areas, and the fourth commandment to me is a gray area because I can read the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, that's black and white. I understand that. But when it comes to the fourth commandment, what is an example of you violating?
Let's keep going then and keep reading and then we can talk about it, all right? Okay, question 117. How is the Sabbath or the Lord's Day to be sanctified? The Sabbath or Lord's Day is to be sanctified by a holy resting all the day. So that kind of answers your question, but not really.
Yeah.
By the way, stealing is not as black and white as you think it is.
All right, killing. Thou shalt not kill.
Killing's not as black and white as you think it is. Yeah, it that's right. It's not thou shalt not kill. It's thou shalt not murder. That's a different. Okay? Is this the birds? Who the heck is that? Oh, that's the Kingston trio you just got. What's the best story? That I was not there for it. Sean was preaching. And Elvis came on, and it was like this song about, it was this song about the devil or something like that. His phone. And it was like perfect timing. I've only heard it secondhand. All right, let's keep going here. Resting all the day, not only for such works as are at all times sinful, but even from such worldly employments and recreations as are on other days lawful, and making it our delight to spend the whole time in the public and private exercise of God's worship. And to that end, we are to prepare our hearts, and with such foresight, diligence, and moderation, to dispose and seasonably dispatch our worldly business, that we may be the more free and fit for the duties of the day. This actually gets right at the heart of what you're talking about, and it gets at the heart of why I have the kind of view of the law that I do. I was just talking with somebody during the break here about the legalism that turns many kids in Reformed circles into atheists because they grow up in it. Because you can't do anything. You are told, and it's beaten into your head, you better fill up that gas tank the night before, because if you have to fill up your gas on Sunday because you were too slothful to fill it up on Saturday, you're sinning and by breaking the Sabbath. Like, that's a real thing that's out there, just as an example. In Reform circles. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I told you guys this before. When we were in that other association of churches, and the first time I ever met these people, the first question they asked me is, "Hi, what's your name?" And the second question they asked me is, "What's your view of the Sabbath?" Not, "Where are you from?" Not, you know, nothing like that. "What's your view of the Sabbath?" And I was like, "That's a little odd." Well, they used this issue as the litmus test for being truly reformed. Okay? You're one of those masters guys who doesn't really believe in the Sabbath at all. You're a dispensationalist who doesn't really believe in that at all because you don't take it seriously like we do. We were in a study. We had the leader. I love this man. Love him to death. Still a friend of mine. But he came here to our church, and he spoke on a Sunday night at one of our houses. And he spoke on, guess what? The Sabbath. And so he did it for like an hour, a little study. And he spent the first 15 minutes saying, "Now, I just want you guys to know, we cannot be legalistic about this issue." And I was very happy with that. I was like, all right, this is going in a good way. He spent 15 minutes talking about this. Legalism on this issue is not acceptable. Then for the next 45 minutes, he told everybody what they could and couldn't do on the Sabbath, giving very specific details of what was forbidden and what was okay. And I was like, "What? Do you remember this?" You were there. It was Bob, yeah. I was just like, "This is so surreal. I don't even understand this. I don't even get it." Like, here's a different issue. The issue of Psalms only. This is kind of a thing that you find in some Reformed circles too. And when I was first kind of became a Calvinist, I was kind of driven towards some of these things. I'm like, these arguments make a lot of sense. And the Psalms only, to this day, one of my very best friends is in a Psalms only church. They only sing Psalms. And so I really wanted to find out, is this something that I think is right or not? And I read everything I could find on the Psalms only guys, and there's a lot of it that I was like, yeah, this really makes sense. And you know what? There was just this nagging feeling underneath that no matter what I read and no matter how good the arguments were, I was like, man, I just feel like crap. I feel like I'm being beaten up reading this stuff. That's not right. That can't possibly be what God wants for me to go and worship him and feel like that. So it was actually something very subjective that kept me from going Psalms only. It was that. Then I started thinking about, I think there's some cracks in these arguments. Like, I was reading Habakkuk one day, and the very end of that book says, basically, sing this entire book to the stringed instruments. It ends the way many of the Psalms do. And I thought, well, now, wait a minute. I'm not allowed to sing this book in Psalms only. Because it can only be one of the Psalms. I'm not allowed to sing Habakkuk. And I thought, well, that's just weird. Why can't I sing the scripture? And then I thought, well, the prophets, like, that's all they did. Their books are like poetry. They're Psalms. Why can't I sing Isaiah? Why can't I sing Isaiah? And I just thought, well, that's just not right. That just doesn't seem right. So I view this stuff on Sabbath very similar to that. I just think that people, you know, we can get specific about this with the language they use here in the second line. Even from such worldly employments and recreations as are lawful on other days, and making it our delight to spend the whole time in public and private worship. So there's a proof text for this. And that proof text is from Isaiah 58. And like, you read the end of that chapter, and it will give you the verse, and it says exactly what they just said there. The problem is, it's taken completely out of context. And so it's like the old joke, Judas hung himself, go and do likewise. Well, those are both Bible verses. What's wrong with that application, right? The same thing here. If you go and read chapter 58, this is where actually knowing chiasms is very helpful. It's a chiasm, and it's matching the beginning of the chapter on fasting and doing your own thing. And you want to know what they were doing on the day of fasting? They're basically beating the crud out of their employees. The workers were, or the bosses were.
That's because they were angry.
they were. No, it's angry fists and all this kind of stuff. Basically, what they were doing is they were sinning. Like they were violating very obvious moral commandments of hate and rage and all these kinds of things. And then when Isaiah picks up the chiasm later, it's got to be parallel with what comes at the beginning. It's not talking about you can't even think your own thoughts on the day. That's not what it's saying. It's saying you're sitting here fasting and worshiping me on Sabbath at the very same time that you're doing all these terrible things to your fellow Jews. That's what it's saying. If people would just learn to read, this wouldn't have been a problem. And it's not all Reformed world that actually has this view. This is a very high Westminster, larger catechism sort of a way of thinking about this. I don't know what it is. It's just kind of a legalistic impulse. And we want to be told what we can and can't do. It just makes life a lot easier. There are some things that you can't do. You should never do it. Like, think about how absurd it would be to say, well, you're not supposed to murder on the Sabbath. This is the Sabbath, for crying out loud. Oh, okay, so I can do that on the other 6 days of the week. Gotcha. Right? Yeah, Carl.
I appreciate you've shown us how you reason through. You read the scripture and say, well, this can't be that if it's telling me this here. And you're actually wrestling with an issue. But part of what I think makes this so confusing to laymen is
it's not just confusing to laymen.
Well, yeah, I recognize that now. There's the issue of taking something that's second level
mm-hmm.
and raising it to
first level.
Okay,
yeah.
So at one point, it doesn't determine whether you're Christian or not, and then you raise it to that first level. You say, no, if you do this now, you're not even a believer.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that, and then there's the whole matter of conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If I'm doing this, but it's violating my conscience,
mm-hmm.
then the scripture says I'm sinning.
That's exactly right.
So my personal conclusion is I can't do anything that violates my conscience or I'm sinning. So my objective is read the text, wrestle with it, come to the best understanding I can, and then do what doesn't violate my conscience.
That's exactly right, and very well said. And if I was to sit here and give you laws of what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath, the problem is there's some people in this room that don't have a conscience problem with that. And I would be binding their conscience to something that they don't have a problem with on what is a secondary issue. And I can't do that. I don't have that right. Only God can bind our conscience. So I want to make one little caveat to what you said there, because we're not to have our conscience bound by traditions of men. Now, everybody has that, I suppose, to one degree or another, with different things. Hopefully, our goal is to have our conscience be bound by God's word and not traditions of men. And we find out it's tradition of men, then we're like, okay, I should chill out a little bit on that one. Okay? God does have the right to bind our conscience. This is why I think the regular principle is such an interesting thing, because it's trying to bind your conscience on things that are positive rather than negative. Okay, I could come up with 10,000 things you are not supposed to do on the Sabbath if I really wanted to. But it's a lot easier for me to say, you know what you should be doing on the Sabbath, on the Lord's Day? You should be going to church with the brothers and worshiping God and doing it in a way that pleases Him. Okay? It's more positive. It puts the focus on Him. And you want to know what's interesting? Is over time, I think that God ends up dealing with our own consciences in ways that we each change. You were telling me, I felt the same thing to one degree or another. You're like, I didn't miss a Bronco game until 3 years ago. For decades. Well, we were the same way. I started getting less enjoyment out of it. And it wasn't like, I don't have a problem going to a Bronco game, inherent problem, on a Sunday. I just don't. I've never come to that point. And for the right reasons, I could do it. Still. Not everybody could. And I don't have the right to tell somebody that they, to kind of flaunt that in front of somebody else. If somebody else has a problem going to a Bronco game on a Sunday, and they have tickets. You have to have tickets, right? Otherwise, you're stealing because you're breaking in. And you can't do that on Sabbath. You can do the other days. You know, I just don't have that right. So God can change our consciences, and I think that that's what Paul says. And if your conscience is bound to something that you're convinced is in His Word, and you violate your conscience on it, you are sinning. Paul says that in Romans 14, just flat out. You are not allowed to sin against your conscience. And so the stronger brother in that case does not have the right to lord their freedom over the weaker brother when their conscience is bound. At the same time, it goes in the reverse. The weaker brother does not have the right to bind a stronger brother with their legalism because their conscience isn't bound. And so this is the one in the many. You have one in the one group, and we aren't all in the same place on probably any of these issues as each other. And so you have to learn secondary, primary. Primary is the gospel issue. Primary is, yes, God does not want us violating His law, and we want to take that seriously. But you know what? We all violate His law all the time. We keep sinning. And so if we turn this into a, well, how can I, it's just, I don't know, it's a subtle trap that we can fall into that subverts the gospel to the gospel becomes all the things I'm doing on Sunday that I'm not, that I didn't do before. It's not the gospel. So.
But one talk I've given this to us, right? I keep thinking about as Christians, we're in this world, but we're not of the world.
Mm-hmm. I do think God wants us to particularly spend the Sabbath thinking about Him in a way that we don't normally. And, you know, as a pastor, it's different because I think about, like, this is my world. I think about this stuff all the time. It's kind of like my job. Almost everybody else, they go to work all day long. And so God doesn't want you sitting there fretting and thinking about how am I going to make money this week or what about this contract that I got going on? And He doesn't want you doing that. He wants you to spend the day thinking about Him and what He's done for you. You know, so putting it in that positive light, then God can start working on you as individuals. And you're like, I really don't know that this is the best use of my time on this day. And you can change the way that you behave on that with regard to that. But somebody else can use that very same time that for one person is a problem, and they can use it in a redemptive way. And I'll use the Bronco game as another example, okay? Because I never went to the Bronco game just to watch the Broncos, ever. I went to be with my family. I went to spend time with friends and to talk to them. And again, you know what? Just, I don't know if it's just me or people that I was with or whatever, we would usually have some pretty amazing conversations during the game. And before the game, and after the game, that we wouldn't have had otherwise. Kind of redeeming the time is the way I look at it. Somebody else can look at that and go, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't have done that. I'm like, okay. You got to show a little grace to each other. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Would this be a good analogy to say that, like a marriage, right? So when wives respect your husband, that's the rule as a wife, that's what I'm supposed to do. But what does that look like? To my husband, it might be something different than somebody else's husband. Like, for example, for me, like if I see my husband's dishes there, oh, I'll just wash them up and he doesn't have to think about it, he doesn't have to worry about it. For him, my husband, it's a sign of disrespect. I think he can't do the dishes. Don't you? You know, and so it's like you have to work that out. There's this principle, this thing you're supposed to do, but how it works out in your life exactly, what does it mean? How do you live it out? It seems like it's kind of one of kinds of things.
Yeah, that's very good, very good. It reminds me of kind of the point of why I wanted to do this a little bit, kind of getting back to, if you just put this onto Sunday, it's very easy to split the ceremonial and the civil side of this, but you know what? Civil life would mean anything that's not ceremonial, put it that way. So it's not government per se. Should we have blue laws that shuts down car dealerships, you know, on Sunday? That's one question. But it's also, well, I have the opportunity to go to this game on Sunday. That's no longer ceremonial life, and so it's something else. I would call it civil life. How does the Sabbath impact my civil life on that day? Does it? And I would say, yeah, it does. Is it better if you were stupid the night before and you didn't fill up your gas tank and you're going to run out of gas on the way to church? Is it better to run out of gas and just sit there until Monday morning? Or is it better to fill up your gas tank and go to church? What do you think? I mean, this is the same stuff Jesus is dealing with these Pharisees on. Same kind of stuff. What is it, better to help a guy, to heal a guy on the Sabbath, or to not, or just let him sit there? He's suffering. Right. Come back to me tomorrow morning. Yeah, Mike. Right.
So a lot of experience with that, and it took me forever, and it exasperated our kids. We have 10 kids, and it just absolutely exasperated. I shared one incident with one Reformed church where they went after my daughter because we were visiting. We talked to the pastor. He was fine with us taking communion because he knew our history. And she went, this old Dutch lady went after my daughter. And my daughter still tried to say she shouldn't have taken communion, blah, blah, blah.
She shouldn't have given communion to one of the kids, but she did, but...
Yeah. But all of it was approved by the pastor. But the point is that rejection and that legalism. My kids are still trying to recover from that today. And the Reformed Baptist side, I'm so thankful because it doesn't do that. It doesn't have the approach that I've learned over the last few years. I feel like with wine is trying to get off. It's about the love aspect. We always want the prescription. But what would I do for Christ because I love him, not because I require to do it? And I find through sanctification,
I would just say a couple things to that. First of all, the stories are, I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Second of all, we have this same problem in Reformed Baptist circles, trust me. And there's also a lot of Presbyterians that don't have this problem. I actually heard a good one about going to a restaurant on Sunday. And this came from pastor at the PCA church down at 10th Pres in 7th Pres, which one is it? In Colorado Springs. And he goes, why can't I plunder the Egyptians on the Sunday? What does that mean? Guess what day it was when God led Israel out of Egypt? It was a Sabbath. What'd they do on the Sabbath? Plundered the Egyptians. That's work. It was kind of a snarky counter response to the legalism. I'm not saying go use it. It's funny. But I'm saying that that's coming from the same kinds of people. Basically, we all have bents towards being legalistic or being antinomian. And I think for each individual, we have to know what our own weaknesses are, and we have to try and do the best we can to not be legalistic and not be antinomian. do what God wants, and show grace to each other and live by the gospel. That's up to each person. I can't make that happen for you. All I can do is kind of hopefully model it as best I can do as a pastor and as a father and as a friend, and tell you why I do it and hope that that's something that you find good. So, yeah, it's not this, you know, becoming Reformed Baptist solves these problems. Trust me, it doesn't solve the problems. It's an individual problem that we all have bents to.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's for being on Reformed Baptist, just the way you explain it, you know about in seminary and St. Paul's and stuff, and we were always terrified to go to church with Sam and his church when we were there for classes because we were afraid of this all manifesting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And going in there and hearing that, we were like, oh, my gosh.
They show grace,
just like you said. Yeah. And we came back, and that's when we were looking for the church and he recommended.
That reminds me of one of the other things that I wanted to say, which is that even if a church has a pretty legalistic approach to this, there are some people in the church that won't, and yet they can live under that. And you want to know what? Some of those people are the most godly people that I have ever met in my life. And in fact, when I'm around them, I just feel dirty. And they don't mean it that way. Like, there are a lot of guys, I think my dad would attest to this, that are in the Reformed Baptist Network, that were in ARBCA, that I'm just like, they would hate me saying this about them. But when I'm around these guys, I'm like, I just want to be like you. I'm not like you. You know? I just feel too common and ordinary and normal. And you're just like, you're not that way. You're something that I want to be. Well, they have something that they can give me, you know, that something that I might kick against a little bit has actually helped them. So, we're not even going to get through the Sabbath today. Let's keep reading this just to kind of look at it. And then we'll move on to the next ones next time. Why is the charge of keeping Sabbath more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors? The charge of keeping the Sabbath is more directed to governors of families and other superiors because they're bound not only to keep it themselves, but to see that it is observed by all those who are under their charge, and because they're prone oftentimes to hinder them by employments of their own. This is basically just saying that, you know, governors of families, fathers, pastors, elders, people that have in a particular role a spiritual authority, God does not want these people going around just telling people that it's okay to violate the Sabbath. And hopefully you've never heard me say that. Because there's, you know, it's the old James thing, teachers will be held doubly accountable. Okay? What are the sins forbidden in the fourth commandment? Omission of all duties required. All careless, negligent, unprofitable performing of them. Being weary of them. All profaning the day by idleness. In doing that which is in itself sinful. By all needless works, words, and thoughts about our worldly employment and recreations. Like, I read this and I go, there's a way that you can take that in a bad way and kick against it. But there's also ways that you can read that and go, I think that's probably a pretty good idea. Now remember, this is not the Bible. This is a catechism written by men trying to understand the Bible and give direction for the people that are under them. Is it wrong to, is it a bad thing to say that I probably shouldn't profane the day by idleness? Is it a bad thing? How could anybody say that's a bad thing? Right? Well, you know, even idleness in that case, like if the nap is just all day long pastor pillow, and the Church of the Holy Comforter, because you're just staying in bed all day long, that would be one thing. But if it's, boy, you know, I spent the whole morning with the church and just had a great time together, and I'm exhausted from that, and I take a nap, that's different to me. Okay, so
back to 118, it kind of goes along with what we were talking about the first in 117 as well, and we kind of
topic that I, or subject in this topic that I have never once heard anybody talk about when talking on the subject. And we kind of touched it just a little bit today, but, and it's funny in a way, but it's kind of serious as well. As we sit here and we say, well, we shouldn't work on Sunday. We shouldn't do that, which is ordinary. We shouldn't blah, 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 blah. What do you do?
No, think about that all the time.
Your whole week is centered around coming and doing, and this is what, as a pastor, you are paid by this church to do.
Right.
Like, if we want to get wrapped up in that, then we should not have a pastor.
Obviously, the quickest way out of that one is, well, God commanded priests in the Old Testament to be working on the Sabbath. That's the easiest way out of it.
But where does that
Yeah, and so
goes out to
all I can do is say that I know that there are guys who have looked at this that are in my profession, and they'll be like, you know what, on my day off, what I do is anything but read the Bible. I go skiing with my family or whatever, you know, go on vacation. Because for me, that's my work, and I need a break from that just like everybody else needs a break from it. And there's some wisdom to that. Like, you can become consumed, anybody can become consumed in their work, including pastors or, in the Old Testament, priests. And, like, you never get a break from it. And what does that do to your kids? My kids are probably, a couple of them are sitting in here right now, and they're like, Dad, you don't do this very well, because, like, you're thinking about this stuff all the time. So I don't know. I don't know what they think. But, you know, I think that Sabbath, the whole point of resting from your work, applies to us too. How many more do we have? Reasons annexed. Reasons set in the beginning of the fourth commandment. We're right at the time to quit. You guys can go and read this stuff at home. We'll go on. Hopefully we've answered some of your questions on the Sabbath. One more thought about it. And I've had to say this to people before, because there are some certain people that really, like, they just really want, just tell me what I can do and what I can't do. And my response is continually, I'm not going to do that. It's not going to happen. Okay? And you'll be like, but just tell me. I really want you to. I'm not going to do that. But I can give you principles that I hope will help you live and obey the commandment in ways that are honoring to God for you and your family, and ways that are also helpful for the family of God by not forcing legalism onto everybody else. And the legalism, if you have something that you're really convicted about, it's not a problem. If you personally, and even if your family, you know, you say, we're not going to do that, that's not a problem. The legalism comes when you force everybody else to do it, and their conscience may not be bound to that. Okay? It's a whole Romans 14 thing that you get into, but we've kind of done that a little. So. This is the Westminster Larger Catechism. So, the Westminster Larger Catechism. You can find it online. It's very, obviously very long. We're in the hundreds. So they've already been 100 questions on it already. So the three forms of, they don't call it three forms of unity, because that's Reformed Church. But for Presbyterians, it's the Westminster Confession, and then the Larger and Shorter Catechism. That's kind of their documents. And I don't think the Baptists really ever, like, took the... I think they took the shorter catechism, but they didn't take the longer one and try and do anything with it.
So if it's Westminster, is it Anglican?
No, it's Presbyterian, believe it or not. Yeah.
Anglicans don't care about people.
Yeah, they've got their, 39 articles, and then they just kind of leave it at that. Book of Common Prayer sort of stuff. All right, you are dismissed.